the Hardball Times Audio, your weekly stop for baseball's biggest stories, past and present, with your hosts, Jen Mac Ramos, Sarah Wexler, and Mary Craig. How's everyone doing today?
Pretty good.
Doing all right. How about you, Jen?
Doing pretty good. Just kind of excited for watching All-Star Game festivities, which brings us into our first topic this week, All-Star Game selection. The All-Star Game is happening this Tuesday in St. Marlins Park in Miami, and there's been a lot of discussion around who made it, who got snubbed, home run derby, futures game. So we're gonna go right to it. Who are we especially glad to see make it onto the All-Star Game roster?
For me personally, gotta be happy for all the first timers who made it. There's a number of them this year, obviously biased, but I'm especially happy that Justin Turner made it because he's been having an incredible season and he absolutely deserves to be there. But also it's like his story is just kind of amazing. You know, he was non-tendered by the Mets, you know, in 2014, Dodgers just kind of picked him up. And I don't think they saw something there, obviously, but didn't necessarily expect him to turn out to be as good as he has been for the past few years. So, you know, see him, you know, go through all that and then make it to the All-Star Game for the first time at age 32. I think that's really pretty cool. I'm also really happy for Ryan Zimmerman. The fact that he, you know, had many down years, especially last season, and now he's the National League starting baseman and completely deservingly so. That also, I think, is pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I think I'll also throw out Roberto Osuna, who's on there. He's replacing someone, I don't know who. I think it's just really great for him to make it. Obviously, he's having a great season, and I think it's just important in a lot of ways for the MLB to kind of give him a stage, give him an audience that he otherwise wouldn't have.
Yeah, definitely. And one person who I'm, you know, kind of surprised to see, but not completely surprised to see, are Justin Smoke with the Toronto Blue Jays. Just knowing his journey through minor leagues, kind of having the label of being a prospect bust on him, and now making it to an All-Star game at the age of 30. I think, you know, just kind of stories like that of like a high round draft pick and having that label of like, oh, he didn't pan out, but now like, it's totally, you know, way later than people expected, but he, you know, has the All-Star label on him now, which is obviously a lot better than prospect bust. But, you know, seeing stories like that is always great, and it's great for baseball.
I completely agree. Just kind of looking at the flip side of things, who do we think got snubbed, who deserves to be there but didn't make it?
I think Felipe Rivero is my biggest one. And I think he probably should have made it as like the first reliever in the NL. So he has a 0.73 ERA, a 0.72 WHIP. He's 10.5 strikeouts per 9 innings, so he's just having like an insane season. But obviously he's not a big name, and I think that probably comes into play, particularly once you get to relievers, that they just kind of pick the big name closers from each league.
Yeah, I, you know, don't want to unduly criticize how players go about selecting the pitchers for the All-Star game, because, you know, this is something where the fans don't get a vote. It's, you know, all done by the MLB players. But I do think that there's something to be said for, you know, them maybe not having quite as much time to do the research into who's truly having the best year. And so I do think that way you have a good point that they kind of end up going with the bigger names and not necessarily the newcomers who are having great seasons. So I think that's a good example of someone who probably deserves to be there, but for whatever reason got ignored.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I think, you know, it's kind of, I guess what I'm trying to say is that with pitchers, you know, obviously because these are the players who see these pitchers all the time, they have a better insight as to, like, who's deserving. Well, I guess I don't want to necessarily say it's better, but it's a different insight than what fans would have just going off of, like, stat lines and the scouting reports it's seen, and as opposed to the people who are actually facing this hitting. And while I get where they're coming from, I feel like, you know, there is that margin of error in choosing, like, which pitcher goes in there. So while it's not a knock on how they choose the pitchers for the All-Star game, I feel like it just ends up to a lot of relievers who are really good possibly being snubbed just because they don't necessarily see, you know, as much game action as starters.
And I don't know if this is true or not, but I think, again, once you get to relievers, I think that's probably when teams really start to look at which teams haven't had a representative been chosen yet. So I think that kind of factors in a lot of these cases as well.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that Wade Davis is the Cubs' only representative, which, I mean, that's a whole other thing. The fact that, you know, you have a World Series champions and the only player there who's going to be representing them is a reliever is kind of shocking. But yeah, I think that's a good example of that being a case of that. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to ask what you guys think of Chris Bryant not making the roster. I know that people were kind of really surprised by that.
Yeah, that was actually going to be something I brought up because more so than Chris Bryant, I think Anthony Rendon was a big snub. You know, third base, as everyone has been saying, it's a really stacked position this year. And there's several people who would have very good arguments for going to the All-Star game as the third baseman, but there's already so many people there that, you know, that just there's not enough room for all of them. I mean, it's evidenced by the fact that the final vote, three of the five National League candidates were third basemen. So, yeah, I think both Anthony Rendon and Chris Bryant were victims of that. I would argue that both of them probably deserve to go over Jake Lamb, which that's not even a knock on Jake Lamb because he's great and he's also having a great year. But I also think he's having the probably fifth best year behind Rendon, Turner, Bryant, and Arenado.
Yeah, I completely agree. Like, just looking at the WAR on the FanGraphs website, like, Jake Lamb is worth 2.2 WAR, whereas Chris Bryant is a little bit higher at 2.8, and just, you know, kind of going off those values alone, and like you said, you know, Anthony Rendon is also having a great year, and his WAR right now is at 3.9, so I think Rendon, you know, just to agree, is a bigger snub than Chris Bryant, and I think it's also just a case of there's so many good third basemen in the National League right now that there's not enough space for all of them.
Yeah, definitely. Another thing that I wanted to get your guys' thoughts on, so I think we can all agree that Buster Posey is far and away the best choice to start at catcher, so obviously the fan vote got that right. However, the only other catcher on the roster is Yadier Molina for the National League. And, you know, obviously Yadier Molina, he is a great catcher. I don't think anyone would really dispute that too much. But is he really the second best catcher in the National League this year? Do we really think that he should be the one who gets that spot?
Yeah, I definitely think that that was kind of like a players respect him, and they know his name. He's been around for a long time, so he's still kind of, I guess, feared by a lot of players, and that's probably what led to a lot of players deciding to choose him for the position, but I definitely think that there were several better candidates. So I agree with you on that point.
Yeah, JT Realmuto, Yasmani Grandal, Wilson Contreras, they're all having better seasons offensively than Yachty is. Mm-hmm. So I guess those are other guys who were kind of victims of the name recognition and veteran respect.
Yeah, I'd have to agree, just kind of looking at the leaderboard for catchers in the NL. I mean, while Yasmani Grandal has, you know, is like 2 points lower batting average, he's also got a BABIP that's so much higher than Molina's, an ISO that's like 60 points higher. For me, the choice would have been, you know, having Posey start and Grandal be the reserve, but, you know, to go with what Mary said, it's definitely all about that name recognition and the fact that, you know, he's a veteran catcher and he has a lot of players' respect. I think, you know, that's probably a huge factor in how Molina made it to the team. And I think a lot of them just want that veteran presence and respectability on their roster. And, you know, it's something that, while doesn't seem completely fair, it still is fair in a sense that it's a respect thing.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, I guess it just plays into the whole, oh, do you go based off of purely what's happened in the first half of the season, or do you factor in the rest of a player's career for that? Because, you know, in some cases that doesn't work because you have rookies in the All-Star game. You know, Aaron Judge, Cody Bellinger both made it in. They don't have, you know, a background to go off of. That's mostly based on, you know, their first half of the season. So I guess I don't think that what you've done in the past should be factored in too heavily. I think it should be focused more so on what you did in the first half of the season, which just, you know, the All-Star game happens to be played during the middle of the season. You know, you don't necessarily know how people are going to pan out going forward. I guess, you know, that's why they used to have two All-Star games to sort of remedy that problem. But obviously that's just kind of too big of a production to keep up. So just based on what we have now, I think you got to focus more on what has been done this year than what's been done in the past. But obviously the players don't agree with me there. So
yeah, I think that's kind of a problem with the All-Star game. It kind of has a lack of identity in the sense that fans want it to be one thing, players think it should be another thing, and then Major League Baseball is trying to make it something else. So there's just a lot of contending views of what the All-Star game should be, and that kind of goes back into who should be selected for the All-Star game.
And I think another big aspect to the All-Star game this year is the fact that it no longer determines World Series home field advantage, so it's not as though they have to play very competitively, and it's a little bit looser, it's a little bit more for the fun aspect of the All-Star game. There's no real pressure on players to have to play as opposed to having a break. You know, we've seen that Mike Trout is opting not to play in the All-Star game, and, you know, I think that's a huge factor in who's playing and who's not. Although, to be fair, I think Mike Trout is also injured.
He is, yeah.
I might be thinking of someone else who opted not to play in the All-Star game, but there's a lot of them, and that's why there's like a lot more reserves this year.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's not quite the same thing, but they didn't alter Clayton Kershaw's schedule so that he could be available to pitch in the All-Star game because he's pitching today, so he won't be available on Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So I guess that's a similar type of thing.
Yeah, I think people are kind of less willing to make concessions for their players in order to go to the All-Star game now, because it doesn't count for anything. And I know that, like, players respect it a lot, and they put a lot of pride into being selected for the All-Star games, but teams themselves, I think, put less stock in it than they do the regular season.
Yeah, definitely. And just looking at this... this tweet from Big League Stew right now. You know, they said, you know, Dallas Keuchel's not playing in it. Starlin Castro's not playing. Corey Kluber, Michael Fulmer, Yu Darvish. You know, those are a lot of big name players. And I think that if, you know, if it was still going for home field advantage, that may be a different case. But as it is right now, you know, why not let it be just something that they have the opportunity to go and have fun and not have to play and get that rest to start the second half of the season, or, you know, whatever. It's just a completely different culture surrounding the All-Star game this year.
What do you guys think of every team having to have a representative for the game? For me, I think that it is more fitting now that it doesn't count for anything, because you don't necessarily need like the very best players to go. So I think it's more fan friendly that way, I guess. But also you obviously still see perhaps more deserving players get left off the roster in order to adhere to this rule.
Yeah, it's like, it's also, I think you end up just shoehorning a lot of, as we said before, relievers in. And if you are, say, a Padres fan, are you really going to be more inclined to tune into the All-Star game because Brad Hand might pitch at some point? I kind of don't think so. And I guess that sort of defeats the purpose a little bit of this requirement. So it's imperfect. I get why they do it, but I don't know that the results are necessarily what they're going for.
Yeah, it almost seems as if like having each team have a representative in the game is kind of like a participation trophy in a way. Like,
and I thought those were bad.
Yeah. And it's like, hey, you're an MLB team, you get a representative in the All-Star game. While it may not necessarily be deserved, and it's just like, okay, you have to have someone on the team to, you know, to show that the, you know, the Padres have a willing and able person to be on the roster. You know, I just think that it kind of defeats the purpose. I think that, you know, the All-Star game shouldn't be determined by how many number of players appear from each team, but rather, you know, the best of the best.
Mm-hmm. And I know for me personally, by the time a lot of these guys get into the game, I'm kind of semi-tuned out anyway. Like, I've seen most of the players, I guess, you know, not to pile it on too much, but most of the players that I guess are worth tuning in for to see play by that point have already come and gone.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And yeah, so kind of going on to the other aspects of the All-Star game, as we're recording this right now, the Futures game is being played. According to MLB.com, 32 of 50 participants from last year's Future Games have already made it to the major leagues, which is a really, really big number. And this year's Futures game features prospects such as AJ Puck from the Oakland A's and also Cal Quantrill from San Diego Padres. You know, there's a lot of big name prospects playing this year. I wanted to get your guys' opinion on how these teams are split up, because there is the U.S. team and the world team. And while the world team, you know, is obviously including the Latin countries, they also include, you know, Canada and a lot of, you know, obviously United States countries. But I always thought it was an interesting way how they split up the future game, as, you know, opposed to AL versus NL, but rather going by the country of birthplace.
Yeah, I don't know. That's always kind of been weird to me, and I basically hate anything that's like USA versus the world. I don't think that is a helpful or productive sort of mentality to bring into anything. And I think that it, although a lot of these players obviously play for the same teams, I think it does, it might create a divide where that's going to be harmful for these international players, and probably harmful for Major League Baseball. If any of these are kind of brought to the major leagues with these players. So I'm not totally a fan of it.
Yeah, I am on the same page there. I think we already have issues existing where there are cultural barriers between American-born players and non-American-born players. And I don't think this is going to, you know, necessarily exacerbate any specific issues there. I think it does kind of reinforce that, like you said, USA versus the world mentality. And I don't think that's productive. I think that you also have this issue of this hegemon. It's like, oh, there's the USA and there's everything else. It's like, you know, using the term world music to describe basically anything that's not music recorded in English. You know, just sort of creating this like false hegemony of things that you're all throwing all together that just, it doesn't really accurately reflect the diversity and the differences within the groups that don't qualify as USA.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, I just keep thinking about, you know, hearing that, you know, there might be some teams where, you know, all the Latin guys are in one corner of the clubhouse and all the American guys, or just like English speaking in general, are in another corner. And I don't think that it's necessarily helping kind of fostering this environment where, like, hey, we're all baseball players, we should, you know, talk to each other and get along and things like that. Instead, it's just kind of pushing that narrative of two different schools of thought with baseball. And it kind of goes back to the differences in baseball cultures, where instead of having these cultures meld in together, it's continued to be separate. And it just makes me wonder why, you know, especially with the minor leagues, where you could be starting to foster that environment of inclusivity and culture melding, you know, to push up into the major leagues, we're just kind of reinforcing that, you know, it's either USA or you're an other.
Mm-hmm. So do you guys have any ideas of what might be a better way to choose the teams?
I think, like we said before, American League versus National League, that seems like the most straightforward way of going about it.
Yeah, I mean, that's the most logical way to go about it. I mean, why does it have to be different than the All-Star Game format if it's something that's played at the All-Star Game? You know, I mean, with the Home Run Derby, it's kind of broken up by, you know, by league, and the All-Star Game is obviously broken up by league as well, so why not the Futures Game?
Yeah, I agree with that. I also was thinking, but like maybe this probably has flaws. If like the American League and National League All-Star teams, like Major League Baseball All-Star teams got together and did sort of like a draft for the Futures Game, so it would kind of be along the line of American League versus National League, but it would be a little more integrated because it's not like these players are going to stay in either the American League or the National League for the rest of their careers.
That's definitely a good point. I think my only concern with that is that, you know, a manager for one of the teams might end up having the USA versus world mentality.
Right.
So I think it would just have to be like a set of ground rules. And I think it would just have to be a little bit more straightforward with the rules, but also be like, okay, you have to choose like maybe one player who plays in, who's in an organization for each division or something like that. So I think it's just something that I would have to think out a little bit more, but it could also be something like, you know, choosing the colors of the uniforms of the team that's hosting the All-Star game. Like with the Marlins, it could be like team orange and team blue or something like that. That way it's a little bit more even playing field, if that makes sense.
Yeah, there's room for creativity with something like that. You could do like animal themed teams versus non-animal themed teams, because I think you have a decent enough mix of those in the minors.
Yeah. And I think another thing with the Futures game, why it's a possibility, why MLB is doing, you know, USA versus World, is it makes me wonder, you know, I haven't read the CBA completely, but it makes me wonder, because minor leaguers aren't in the union, how much that has an effect on MLB choosing why it's U.S. versus World. And then you have the major league events like the Home Run Derby and the All-Star Game with, you know, players in the union being AL versus NL.
So yeah, that might have something to do with it.
So that just makes me wonder, like, what kind of protections do minor leaguers have when they're at a major league stage like the Futures game?
Have they released the PDF of the CBA yet?
For the new CBA, as far as I know, no, they have not.
Okay, that's what I thought.
So that would be very interesting to see once it's public. But speaking of the Home Run Derby a little bit, the participants of the Derby this year include Giancarlo Stanton, Gary Sanchez, Mike Moustakas, Miguel Sano, Cody Bellinger, Charlie Blackman, Aaron Judge, and Justin Bour. Do we think there's anyone who got snubbed for the Home Run Derby? Anyone who we're particularly happy to see make it in? What do you guys think of this year's Home Run Derby participants?
I think Logan Morrison might have had a point about his deserving to be there. I don't like that he threw Gary Sanchez under the bus to do it. I think Sanchez is a deserving participant. He, you know, was hurt for some of this year, so he doesn't have as many home runs as the other participants. But the power is obviously there, and he has like 30 plus home runs in, like, you know, not even a full year of playing from his, you know, career so far. So I don't like that he went about trashing another player to make his case that he should be there, but I do think he might have had a point that he should have been there, especially because he didn't make the All-Star roster, which he probably should have made the All-Star roster too. So yeah, I think he was kind of a snub from both the All-Star game and the Home Run Derby, but his attitude is such that I guess I don't feel too bad about him not being there.
Yeah, definitely. I think, you know, while he had a good point, it was totally not the way to go about things. I feel like he could have done so without throwing Sanchez under the bus, but really just criticizing the selection format in itself. I feel that, you know, there's obviously with only 8 spots, you know, and 4 for each league, it's kind of hard to figure out who's the most deserving other than looking at home run number totals. But I will say that I'm especially glad to see Bellinger and Judge make it in, considering how well their rookie campaigns have been this year and how much power that they have.
God, can you imagine them going up against each other in the second round?
That makes me wish that I had a ticket to see it up close.
Yeah, I really hope that's what happens. It's what I'm predicting. It just from a narrative standpoint and just from a logical standpoint, just looking at who they're up against, I mm-hmm. think that would be the absolute best thing to see happen.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think now, because of the whole Logan Morrison thing, I'm rooting for Gary Sanchez. But he obviously has the toughest competition, being the 8th seed and going up against Ant. But I think it would be really fun if... Well, no, I don't know. I was going to say I think it would be really fun if he could win. But I also think that Miami might need Stanton to win or to at least make it to the final round with it being in Miami.
Yeah, I think I would not at all be surprised to see Stanton repeat. He is obviously good enough. And, you know, as much as I love watching all the rest of these guys mash dingers, I love watching Giancarlo Stanton mash dingers. It's just one of the most physically impressive things to watch in baseball, I think.
Totally. I think that regardless of where the All-Star game is, the Home Run Derby should always be in Miami.
Yes.
Because of the dinger machine?
Yes.
Okay.
Like, it was not, like, it was made for the Home Run Derby. Like, it's fine, like, during every game, kind of annoying, but, like, the Home Run Derby is its bread and butter, I think. I think it's
Are they going to run it on every single home run?
I hope not.
I feel like it shouldn't. For every home run, but I think for the final home run, it should do something completely absurd.
Yeah.
Maybe it could spit out confetti instead of water. Maybe there would be dancers around the machine when the final home run is hit. I just feel like there's something ludicrous that has to happen with it in the Home Run Derby. I just don't know if it should happen every home run.
What about cats?
I am here for cats.
Yes. I don't know what the cats are going to do. I don't know if they're just going to release a bunch of cats from the dinger machine, but I just feel like, you know, we've seen there's at least one cat that likes it, so I think logic dictates that other cats will probably like it too, and they think that would be a fun little callback to that. Not actually. I don't think that is actually a thing that should happen, but it's
maybe amusing. The winner of the Home Run Derby gets to take home the Home Run Sculpture Cat.
Yes. There you go.
There we go.
So, kind of moving on. The first half is over today. And as the standings are right now, it's not necessarily what a lot of people would have expected when the season began. So who and what surprised us this year? Which teams are total surprise? Which players? What did we see coming in the first season? And what didn't we see coming? What surprised us the most?
So I think we kind of have to start off with talking about the Cubs. It's obviously difficult to repeat their win total from last season, but I don't think anybody predicted them being this bad, and especially in such a weak division. So I think that that's kind of one of the biggest stories of the first half.
Yeah, definitely. They're finishing the season, or the first half of the season, 2 games below .500 and 5 back of the divisional lead, which on the one hand, for a team that's 2 games below .500 being 5 back, is actually not that bad, because it's not like the Brewers have been, you know, that incredible. But still, the fact that it is the Brewers on top of the divisional standings and everyone else, including the Cubs, is below .500 is definitely surprising. I mean, the race is far from over and the Cubs could turn things around, but I don't think anybody envisioned a collapse quite this substantial for them.
Yeah, I think what's surprising me the most is that, like, even though the NL Central isn't the strongest division by any means, the fact that the only team above 500 in the NL Central is the Brewers, who are still kind of in the midst of rebuilding, seeing them have a five-game lead in the NL Central is pretty unexpected. And the fact that they were able to hold it up until, you know, till the All-Star break, is something I feel like they're eventually going to regress a little bit, but with the way that the Cubs are this year, that's not to say that, you know, the Brewers don't have a chance. It just depends on how much they regress.
Yeah.
Yeah. I also think we should note that there's only one division in the National League that has multiple teams above 500. And that's the NL West, which I think is also kind of surprising because that has in recent years been a pretty weak division. It's surprising that it's the Diamondbacks and Rockies that are up there. You know, I think most people didn't expect them to have played as well as they have so far. You know, I think I knew that they had the potential to be better this year than they have been in recent years, but I guess I didn't think that they would be hanging in quite as much as they are at this point in the season. I didn't think the Giants would be this bad. I think no one really thought they would be this bad because no one could have foreseen Madison Bumgarner's ridiculous injury. But yeah, in general, I'd say the NL West outside of the Dodgers is a pretty big surprise. Outside of the Dodgers and Padres, the Padres are where you'd expect them to be.
Oh, yeah, totally. The Padres, you know, at this point are, if they don't completely have a fire sale, then they're doing something wrong. But, yeah, I'd have to agree. You know, I did not expect the NL West to be the strongest division in the National League. That being said, I'm not completely too surprised at the Rockies' success this season. I don't expect them to, you know, win the division, but seeing them make it in as a wild card is not completely out of the question. I don't think that they'll make it to the World Series, but I think it's just kind of a good start to their window. And I think that their window really is like 2018-2019. So the fact that they're just doing this well in 2017 shows, you know, the progress that they've made since their last playoff appearance and their and the rebuilding they've done since then.
I agree. And then if you look at the American League, I don't think anybody could have predicted the Astros having a 15.5 game lead, because that's pretty ridiculous for the halfway point.
To be fair, Sports Illustrated, the cover where they said that the Astros are going to be the 2017 world champions. So
true.
But on the other hand, Sports Illustrated cover curse.
Yes. They might have gotten it right that the Astros were going to be very good, but did they think that the rest of the AL West would be this bad? I don't know about that. They have been really, really bad.
Yeah. And I think a lot of that is the A's never trying to figure out if they're going to do a full rebuild or actually compete. And then there's the Angels with no farm system whatsoever and a lot of money to spend, so that's never necessarily a good combination. And then the Mariners are still in the midst of a rebuild, so it's not necessarily that they were expected to be at the top. But then there's the Rangers, who seem like they could be in contention a little bit, but it also seems like right now they're just struggling to get to 500 and stay above 500.
Yeah, I saw some stat about how the Rangers last year, I don't remember the exact numbers, but they did really, really well in one-run games, and they're doing very, very poorly in one-run games this year. And I guess that is kind of a suggestion of regression from one year to the next, because that wasn't a sustainable winning strategy, just relying on, you know, close games like that.
Totally. In the American League, I will also say that I'm kind of surprised by how well the Twins are doing this season. They're, you know, as of recording, currently 2.5 games back of the AL Central lead. And while, you know, it wasn't expected that the White Sox would be any good, you know, the Twins are better than the Royals and the Tigers, who have both recently, you know, in the last 5 years, made it into the postseason. And considering how the Twins have kind of just been rebuilding the farm system and going through that process, you know, seeing them compete this year was a big surprise.
Yeah, I think that they have a shot at overtaking Cleveland for the divisional lead. That is definitely surprising. I don't know that I think they will. I think that Cleveland is a really good team and they will probably, you know, play better than they have been in the second half of the season. The Twins still have a shot at a wild card. You know, obviously they have some AL East teams to contend with there, but yeah, they're hanging in there a lot better than I think most people would have expected.
Yeah. Yeah. Speaking of the AL East, seeing the Orioles and the Blue Jays at the bottom of the division, considering their postseason games last year, that's a little bit of a surprise. But, you know, obviously the AL East, you know, is a strong division, but didn't quite exactly expect the Blue Jays and the Orioles to be down there.
Yeah, it's definitely a little surprising, but I think last year a lot of people with various degrees of evidence to support this were saying that the Orioles weren't as good a team as their record indicated for much of the season, and people kept waiting for them to drop off. So I guess this is the drop-off point. I think the Blue Jays, it's kind of weird. The entire team just forgot how to hit, basically. Like, the offense is suddenly, like, absolutely terrible. And it's basically the entire team all going through massive slumps at the same time, which is never a good thing. But I think a lot of it is also kind of to do with age. A lot of their players are kind of getting up there. So I think that it's kind of to be expected that there would be a little bit of a drop off. But again, I don't think that people were expecting them to be this bad.
Yeah, no, I agree. I was just thinking about the Blue Jays and age, and, you know, you have Troy Tulowitzki and Jose Bautista, you know, kind of getting up there in age and obviously, you know, past their peak. But I'm also thinking about the loss of Edwin Encarnacion to their offense. And everyone knew going into the offseason last year they had to make a choice between Bautista and Encarnacion. And, you know, obviously that would be a huge loss to their offense. And then, you know, with the Orioles, Zach Britton is probably still in the bullpen somewhere. Terrible joke, I had to make it. But, you know, I don't think that they have the same level of offense that they did last year. I think a lot of the offense was just lucky timing and lucky hits. I don't think it was necessarily sustainable, but I didn't think that they would drop off this much.
And I think another thing surprising with the AL East is how good the Yankees were starting out the season, especially for kind of like in a semi-rebuild-ish mode. I think people were expecting them to start to really contend for the division lead either next season or the following one. But again, I guess nobody really could have predicted just how good Aaron Judge would be. And I think that's kind of a huge part of how good the team as a whole is.
Yeah, I guess that is a good launching point for individuals who we have been surprised by this year. Aaron Judge is obviously a really good example. He's kind of the face, I think, of the home run surge, just because, you know, he has 30 home runs in the first half of the season. That's insane. He also leads the American League in basically every offensive category except for stolen bases. So yeah, he has, I think, you know, he was expected to be good, but he wasn't expected to be this good. And I think people didn't necessarily think he would be more than just someone who could hit for power. And he's proven to be more than that so far.
Yeah, totally. And I would also say that I was not expecting Joey Votto's surge this year. I mean, he's always been a consistently good hitter, but I didn't think that he would be worth nearly 4 WAR. He's at 3.9 right now. And I think that, you know, the Reds aren't necessarily competing this year, but having someone like Votto hitting this well with an extremely high ISO at 318, I didn't think that that's something that was going to happen this year.
Yeah, I agree with that, both of those picks. And I guess on the other side of things, I was not expecting Verlander to be so bad this season. I think that it'll be interesting if he gets traded at the deadline and if he can kind of make up in the second half for his poor first half performance. But I guess it's kind of interesting that Verlander has dropped off and Porcello has dropped off this season. I don't think that people really predicted either of these pitchers to be just as underperforming as both of them are. So that's kind of on the more negative side of surprising.
On the positive side of surprising, can I just mention Edinson Volquez threw a no-hitter?
Yes.
That happened, and I'm so happy it did.
I love Edinson Volquez from a completely irrational standpoint. So seeing him throw a no-hitter was probably one of the highlights of the first half of the season.
Yeah. Absolutely. If you had asked me to predict what pitcher would throw a no-hitter, even if I was trying to pick someone unexpected just because, you know, someone like Kershaw or Scherzer was too obvious, it would not have been Volquez in a million years. So good for him.
And that's the best part of baseball, is the you can't predict baseball side of things. So Volquez throwing a no-hitter is a huge example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely highlighting some of the things that baseball fans love the most about the sport, is just kind of how unpredictable it is from game to game, from start to start. And I think that that's really great about it.
Totally. So yeah, kind of going on to Twitter questions this week. Alan, who is at AlanBoone5, says, do you think Willie Calhoun and or Alex Verdugo will be contributors to the Dodgers down the stretch?
What was that?
So, Sarah.
Yes. So this question, I believe, is mostly directed at me. By down the stretch, this means this year. I think Verdugo probably has a more realistic shot than Calhoun does of being a contributor for the Dodgers, just in large part because it seems more likely that the Dodgers will have need for another outfielder than another second baseman. They are, pretty deep there. So the fact that Calhoun is not a great fielding second baseman, despite the fact that, you know, he's a great hitter, I can't see there being an immediate enough need for him that he would be a contributor this year. I think there's something to be said for the fact that, you know, Calhoun is as far along as he is in his development and still hasn't gotten it together defensively, that maybe he doesn't really belong in the National League. Maybe he would better serve an American League team as a designated hitter. So I think there's a decent chance he's a trade piece if the Dodgers do decide to, you know, make a trade at the deadline. But yeah, I think if either of them does contribute, it's more likely to be Verdugo than Calhoun. That's my prediction.
All right, I'll agree with that.
I will also agree with that.
Cool.
Analysis.
Crystal, who is at Crush Song, says, so far, what's your favorite play from this season, not including the teams you normally root for?
So for me, it's Jared Dyson's catch to rob Chris Davis that happened sometime in the middle of May, I think. Just because it was a spectacular catch. And then he flipped over onto his feet, and it was just so suave. And so it was a great catch. You know, great execution all around, and then it had a little bit of flair to it, which is fantastic.
I'm going to go with Jen. This might be a little bit emotionally conflicting for you, so I want to hear how you felt about this, but the play that Nolan Arenado made to throw out Ty Block, where he, like, I don't even know how to describe it. He, like, you know, made this amazing, like, block, and then from his knees, but, like, also kind of lying down and facing the wrong way, he makes this throw to nail tie block at first base. And it, like, my description does not do it justice at all. You know, just Google, like, Nolan Arenado sitting throw to watch it if, you know, anyone listening hasn't seen it. But, yeah, it's, you know, anything Nolan Arenado does is probably amazing. But this, I think, was kind of above and beyond, even by his standards. So, I don't know. Jen, was that tough for you to watch? You know, being two guys that you feel so emotionally attached to?
It was very hard to watch because when I first saw it, I didn't realize Ty Block was the batter. So I was just mostly like freaking out at how amazing Arenado was. And for those of you who, you know, don't follow me on Twitter, I'm a huge fan of Nolan Arenado's defense to the point where I would actually propose to his defense if I could. And I'm also a huge fan of Ty Block, who I have known since he was in High A San Jose in 2013, and seeing his progress throughout the years and knowing that he is a genuinely nice guy has me rooting for his success a lot. But that play, after realizing that it was Ty Block at bat, I was just like, I have no idea how to feel about this anymore. I love Nolan Arenado, but that was just such bad BABIP on Ty Block's part. But I also don't expect pitchers to be great hitters. So I was mostly like, okay, I'm just going to savor the fact that Nolan Arenado is amazing at defense.
That's fair.
And I would have to say that my favorite play this season, not from a team that I root for, is probably going to be Dustin Pedroia's play.
Yeah, that's right.
And I will say that Mary did not influence this pick at all.
No.
just kind of seeing Pedroia save this errant throw and get the runner at first after he made a wide turn was, you know, a testament to Pedroia's defense and such heads up thinking. And, you know, it's just a good play to watch and just one of those wacky, unthinkable plays that it's like, okay, this guy's probably going to make it to second because of the errant throw. Nothing's going to happen here. And then Pedroia just dives and gets the ball and throws it to first after he makes such a wide turn and gets him out at first anyway.
And Napoli was asked about the play after the game, and he said that in all of his years playing with the Rangers, he's never seen a carom that went that way off the brick wall. So it was just like an improbability factor of like 1,000.
Mm-hmm. So the next question is from Mark, who is at Dodger Deegan. I hope I pronounced that right. Two questions, which is first half MVPs and Cy Young winners, and two is trade deadline predictions.
Okay, so for Cy Young winners, we're probably going to all be in agreement at this point that it is Sale and Scherzer, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Unless,
I think it's pretty hard to argue otherwise. If, you know, we're just going based on the first half of the season, they've been pretty far and away better than everybody else.
Totally.
I don't think that's necessarily going to be what happens for the remainder of the season. I know I'm really defensive here, but Clayton Kershaw is heating up, and I think that race is going to end up being a lot tighter than it has seemed so far. But yeah, if it's just first half, then yeah, Sale and Scherzer.
All right, MVPs, anyone?
Well, again, gotta shout out Aaron Judge and the fact that he leads every offensive category except stolen bases, pretty much. I really don't see how you can argue for much of anyone else in the American League. The National League is a little bit trickier. I'm going to go with Paul Goldschmidt by a hair, although you could make really good arguments for Joey Votto, for Bryce Harper, and possibly even for Justin Turner. He, you know, missed some time, but the fact that he has been as good as he has been and has been as valuable as he has been, even with, you know, the time that he missed, I think he has a decent argument that you can make for him too.
Yeah, I think the field in the NL is a little more spread out with, like, probably 4 to 5, like, very legitimate candidates at this point. But, I think I love Paul Goldschmidt, so I'll go with that.
I would have to say that, you know, obviously in the AL there's Aaron Judge, but I wouldn't be surprised if Jose Altuve is also in discussions about AL MVP at the end of the year, but I think Aaron Judge might just, you know, run away with it in the second half. But in the first half, definitely Judge. As for NL, probably Paul Goldschmidt, just because, you know, he's always been a consistently good player, but this year has just been, you know, combined with the D-backs' success, you know, it's, you know, he's high up there on the list of first half MVP guys. But, you know, throwing into the other names in the competition, you know, Joey Votto, Bryce Harper, maybe Anthony Rendon. He's been having an amazing year, and he's worth 3.9 WAR as well. I think, you know, people definitely shouldn't sleep on Rendon as a dark horse in the NL MVP race.
Yeah. So for Mark's other question, what are our trade deadline predictions for this year?
Johnny Cueto is definitely gone from the Giants at the trade deadline. That's my prediction. I feel like, you know, regardless, Cueto's not going to be with the Giants after this year. He's got an opt out of his contract, and with the way that the Giants are this season, you know, this is obviously not what Cueto wants to play for. I think the Giants are going to make the decision to offload him sooner so that they can get prospects back, and not just have him walk and not get anything out of it, especially with the potential of Madison Bumgarner coming back into the rotation. They're going to need a rotation space, since they said that Ty Block is not going to go back into the bullpen, and it's either going to be getting rid of Cueto or DFAing Matt Moore, who has not been doing very well for the Giants.
How many relievers do you think the Nationals are going to pick up at the deadline?
Yes, that sounds like what they need to do. Yeah, I guess that's what really stands out of the teams that are competing or look to be postseason bound. The Nationals really got to do something about that bullpen. My significant other is a Nationals fan, and he has said many times to me that what the Nationals need to do is not pick up one great closer, as a lot of people have suggested. You know, they've hammered them for not signing Jansen or Chapman, but that's not what it would have made the difference. What they need is really multiple solid relievers. Because, yeah, there's not much of anyone in that pen who's been reliable for them. So, yeah, I think they're going to need 2 or 3 at the very least.
Yeah, I think that's actually the smarter way to go about it, rather than, you know, spend big for one name, have smaller names who can help bolster the bullpen as a whole and spend less on them. That's actually the smarter way to go. I would also say that the Rockies need starting pitching.
Mm-hmm.
That's been one of their weak points this year. I know John Gray's just coming back, but with Tyler Anderson going back on the DL and Chatwood not exactly being the best, and then Sensatella being sent down, you know, they need to find a starter, and that's going to be one of the keys for them if they want to make a wild card spot.
Do you guys think they could pick up Sonny Gray? He might. He's shown promise in the last couple of starts, and they might be able to get him relatively
soon. Yeah, I think that's definitely a possibility. I've also heard that the Astros might be making a play for Sonny Gray. But I think every team that needs a starter is going to try and make a play for Sonny Gray with how relatively inexpensive the package would be.
Yeah, and I think he would be a good fit for the Rockies just because he is such a ground ball heavy pitcher. And I know that is something that is pretty valuable if your home field is Coors Field. So I think that is probably something that the Rockies are strongly considering if they want to have a shot at the postseason.
Totally. I also think that the A's are going to be sellers at the deadline. I think that in any instance that this is they have to, it's basically do or die, rebuild or don't rebuild for them, and they have to make a decision whether or not to let the new guys, the rookies, come up and just field the team with the minor leaguers who are ready and build a team around them. And there's going to be a lot of expendable guys, and it's just a matter of whether or not they're going to pull the trigger. So our last Twitter question comes from Kaz, who is, I hope I'm pronouncing it right this time, Kaz, Kazuto Yamazaki. And please tell me how to pronounce it if I butchered it again. Who are y'all's favorite Spooner name?
So for anybody listening who doesn't know, which if you participate in baseball Twitter, you likely know what a Spoonerism is. It's when you switch the first letter of someone's first name and the first letter of their last name, or if it's like, you know, a consonant combination thing, you might switch that. There's not really any hard and fast rules that people seem to adhere to with it. But so one that I was just thinking about recently that I think is vastly underrated and might be my favorite, Wade Miley is spoonerized to Made Wiley. That's a phrase, and it's a good one. So I'm going with Made Wiley.
I think we have to, like, obviously shout out Cole Hamels for being Whole Camels.
You can't go wrong with Whole Camels.
But I think my favorite one, and you guys, you're probably going to laugh at this, is Blake Wood, which turns into Wake Blood.
And I think sounds like a heavy metal band name or something.
Yeah, I think it's versatile, and it's probably not a guy that people are going to think of, so I think he gets bonus points for that. And you can just do a lot. It's kind of dark, but that's good.
Yeah, I have thought a lot about this, and I have actually tried to look through ballplayers' names just to see what would be a good Spoonerism. But I think I'd have to go with the classic Cole Hamels, because the picture that you just get from that is you see all of a camel. And I also want to shout out Cole Hamels' current mustache, which is pretty amazing right now.
And it's amazing the word that you'd use.
Amazing in that it looks like someone transported back to a 70s cop drama that he would fit in right with a cast of Chips.
That's good, because it fits perfectly with a Spoonerism, because now he looks like a guy who could smoke like whole packs of Camel cigarettes a lot of the time. So I think that's even more fitting.
Exactly. There you go. all right. On that note, let's talk about this week's Hardball Times articles. So on Monday, we had a piece called Remembering Tony Conigliaro by Alfonso Tusa. Here, Alfonso tells the story of stumbling across a magazine with a cover featuring the 1967 Red Sox Impossible Dream Team. The cover story transports him back to being a young boy who was just learning about the game of baseball. The article that he reads recreates an extra inning game that he'd listened to with his brothers, one that had remained especially vivid in his mind. His recount is really lovely, in spite of the pushy newsstand guy who kept trying to kill his vibe by insisting he pay for the magazine he was reading. Alfonso's article is also available to read in Spanish, and it's linked at the beginning of the article. Thought that was kind of cool. On Tuesday, there was no article because it was the 4th of July. Happy belated 4th, everybody. Wednesday, we had another part in John Pascal's Coffee Sipper series. This one focused on those who played one game who were pinch hitters or pinch runners. So there are 95 so-called pinch sippers in MLB history. The most notable example is, of course, Eddie Goodell, the dwarf signed to a one-day contract by the incomparable Bill Veeck. Goodell drew a walk in his sole plate appearance, which, you know, between his small stature and the pitcher just laughing so hard that he couldn't throw strikes, that was a very memorable sole career plate appearance. That said, he's hardly the only one, and it's nice to see John give many of the other pinch sippers their due.
And on Thursday, we have Jim Bunning's Brethren, Baseball Man Who Went Into Politics by Alex Remington. So as the title suggests, Alex compiles a list of a number of players who went on to have political careers after their retirement from baseball. So the list includes Maglio Ordonez, who's the mayor of Saltillo, Venezuela, John Tenner, who was a congressman from Pennsylvania and then became governor. And there are two others, Wilmer Mizell and Fred Brown. So make sure to read the piece if you want to know how successful each of these four players is in their political careers. And then on Friday, we have Dreaming of a Free Amateur Market by Jack Moore. So he revisits the old question of full free agency. Wouldn't the wealthiest teams then get all of the stars? He asserts that the answer to this question is no. And then creates kind of a possible scenario if baseball abolished the draft and allowed prospects to sign with whichever teams they wanted. So he argues that doing this might actually increase parity, particularly with respect to drafting players and signing international players. So if you want to find out why the answer to this question is no, make sure to read this piece.
Yeah. And for next week articles, on Monday, we have Frank Jackson on Rochester, the Rock of Ages of Minor League Baseball. On Tuesday, we have Shane Tortolotti on the book Weaver on Strategy. On Wednesday, we have John Rogel on with a midseason review of the Strike Zone. On Thursday, Evan Davis has a breakdown and analysis of every Clayton Kershaw homer allowed this season. And finally, on Friday, we have Jan Moffitt with some ruminations on this year's Marlins. So a quick update on some baseball news that's happening as we're recording this. The U.S. World Futures team is currently leading world 4-0 in the top of the first. And on a completely different note, the White Sox are currently being blanked by the Rockies at Coors Field in the 7th. So, obviously that game's going to be over when we record, but, you know, goings-ons in the world of baseball as we're recording this. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of the Hardball Times Audio. You can find all the articles mentioned in this episode at hardballtimes.com, and you can find the site on Twitter at @hardball_times. I can be found on Twitter at Jen Mac Ramos. You can find Sarah at SarahWexler32. You can find Mary at Mary M. Craig. Thanks to our theme music from bensound.com. You can find all the episodes of the Hardball Times audio on hardballtimes.com and iTunes. Please rate and subscribe and review if you want to. And be sure to tune in next week for another episode.